The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Hillel, is the last of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Tapper families.
One of the most dramatic moments at the Passover Seder is when we lift up a cup of wine and we say, Shebechol dor v'dor omdim oleinu l'chaloseinu. In every generation, they try to destroy us. V'akodesh boruch hu matzileinu miyodom. But Hashem saves us from their hands. The form of this attempted annihilation from generation to generation is not always constant. Sometimes, as the story of Purim, it was physical annihilation. Other times, like that of Hanukkah, it was spiritual annihilation. And very often, in Hashem's protecting us through all these generations, He uses human vehicles. Mordechai and Esther at Purim, the Chashmonoim, the story of Hanukkah. In fact, there's a Gemara in Megillah, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, 11a, describes the prophecy. It was written in Leviticus in Vayikra Chof Hei, 25, that Hashem will never forsake us in the Golos. It cites the great people of those generations that Hashem inspired and turned inspired others to minimize the damage and to be with us in these very difficult times. If one would try to compose a list of all those great men of history, all those great people, the Mordechai and Esthers of history, I'm sure on the top of everyone's list would be three individuals who had a significant role in the period that's under discussion. One was Hillel. This is the topic of tonight's lecture. Another, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He was the one who was responsible for having saved the time of the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin at Yavne, the family of Hillel. There's, of course, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, whose Torah we study to this day. The major works of our study, the Mishnayos, the Sifra, the Sifri, the Tosefta, are works of Rabbi Akiva's students quoting their master, Rabbi Akiva. From the birth of Hillel to the death of Rabbi Akiva, we have a span of almost 250 years. Rabbi Akiva was born less than 10 years after Hillel died. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew both these people. He was a student of Hillel's. He was a teacher of Rabbi Akiva. And each one of these rare individuals had the distinction that they, like Moshe Rabbeinu, lived for 120 years. You turn page 1. This is section 1, paragraph B. The Sifri, and this is the Sifri is a halachic medrash, which deals with the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, and Deuteronomy Devarim. In almost the last citation of the Sifri, we have this quote, that four died at the age of 120, Moshe, Hillel the elder, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rabbi Akiva. And if you notice the quote from the Sifri, that all of their lives were divided into three segments, each one of 40 years. If we look at the lives of Hillel, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rabbi Akiva, as well as Moshe Rabbeinu's, their most productive years were the last years of their lives. Each one entered a position of leadership at the age of 80 and were blessed with Arichas Yomim of 40 years to be able to teach and to make an impact on their generation. In terms of Hillel, Rabbi Yochanan, Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva, the second 40 years of their life, from the year 40 to the year 80, was totally devoted to serious study. The earliest 40, though, as we see, was not. It's not clear from the Sifri why is it that their lives took such a turn. The one thing we can surely learn from them is that age is not an impediment to lead a productive life. And in fact, when we deal with Hillel, Rabbi Yochanan, Zakkai, and Rabbi Akiva, especially Rabbi Akiva, who was totally unlettered until he was 40, that they spent 40 years of their life in almost, would be relative, anonymity to prepare themselves to 40 years, the last 40 years of such tremendous influence. What is the story of Hillel? Where did he come from? When was he born? Who were his teachers? If you notice page 1, paragraph A, Hillel's roots were from Bovel, from Babylon. And in fact, we see from this quote from the Gemara in Sukkah in 20a, Chof Amud Aleph, that Babylon was a Mokum Torah, was a citadel, was a place of learning. Even while Eretz Yisrael was waning and waxing and going through all kinds of persecutions and all kinds of difficulties, Babylon remained an anchor for world Jewry. The Medrash Tanhuma in Parshas Noach makes the statement that when the Jews were first exiled to Babylon, and this was under the when the king was Yechoniah, and there was a major exile, the cream of Jewry were exiled there. They opened yeshivas. And the yeshivas they opened in the major city population centers of Bovel remained intact for hundreds and hundreds of years. And in fact, until the end of the period of the Gaonim, this is in the 11th century, we have some almost 1,500 years of uninterrupted Torah learning. As we all know, most of the Jews who were exiled did not return back to Eretz Yisrael. But even though they did not return, they were actively involved in the Jewish life. And their yeshivas were producing great scholars. Ezra, was a product of Bovel. Of course, his Baruch ben Neriah, his Rebbe, was a Talmud, was a disciple of Yirmiyah Hanovi, Jeremiah the prophet. But in order to stay by his Rebbe and to be close to him, he remained in Bovel even after the first Aliyah, This is the first emigration to Eretz Yisrael. Even after the second emigration, and then when the temple was built, he still stayed behind to be by his teacher, Baruch ben Neriah. It was only after Baruch ben Neriah passed away, and this was after the temple was built, did Ezra go up from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. And he rejuvenated the community there. The same process of rejuvenation we find by Hillel. Hillel went up, and was, as the Gemara explains, he restored Torah. He had made a tremendous impact by virtue of his learning. Who were Hillel's rebbes? Where did he learn from? The Gemara often quotes, and this is in Pirkei Avos, that he was a student of Shemaya and Avtalion. But the truth is that many years before he came to Eretz Yisrael to study at the feet of Shemaya Avtalion, he was a great scholar. In fact, if you turn to page 2, on paragraph E, regarding three things, this is Yerushalmim Sochem, regarding three things that Hillel come up from Babylon to seek confirmation from Shemaya and Avtalion. In other words, he had learned through, as we see, Kol HaTorah Kula, he had learned through all of the knowledge of the Torah Shebaal Peh, and he had three problems that he had personally a solution for, but he wanted confirmation. Hillel expounded on these three subjects. And in truth, this is when he came to Eretz Yisrael, spoke over his ideas with Shemaya and Avtalion, they confirmed his theses. And this is how the Rav Isaac Halevi learns, and the Korban Eda, one of the great commentators on the Yerushalmi, learns that he came up. This was his first. This is the first time he came to study in Eretz Yisrael. We say his first 40 years were relatively non-productive. Means in comparison with the other 40 years that he studied the feet of Shemaya and Avtalion, but he was an accomplished scholar even then. So we have a person who had studied in Bavel and Babylon, became a great scholar. And wanted to grow, didn't stop growing. And came, left, evidently would be the place of where his forefathers were, came to a strange land. And it seems amidst great poverty, rose to be the greatest scholar of his time. Just in the essence of what his family, just what the personal side of Hillel. What was his family? We know there's a Yerushalmi in Kilayim that he, from his mother's side, he was a descendant from the house of David. But he, in actuality, was from the tribe, from his father's side, from the tribe of Binyamin, from Benjamin. Because he had some relationship to the Davidic line, but not, he wasn't truly an heir, as he was from Binyamin. Those who had the position of Reish Galusa, the exilarch, the head of the exile, the one who was the closest thing to being a Jewish king outside of Israel, was a Ben Acher Ben, was a true descendant from the paternal side of David HaMelech, of King David. And actually the exilarchs were actually his true descendants, David's descendants. But he came from a very prestigious family. We don't know much about his immediate family except for a statement of Hillel that's quoted in the name of Hillel, that he had tefillin of his grandfather. His mother's father's tefillin were in his possession. Those were the tefillin he had. Hill also had a brother. If you see on page 2 in paragraph D, the Gemara describes the relationship between the two brothers. Hillel occupied himself with learning Torah. Evidently, he made a meager living on the side, but all his basic energies were devoted to learning Torah. Shachna, his brother, was involved in business. And it seems Shachna did not help him did not really give him any help. When Hillel already became the famous Hillel, Shachna said, "You know what? Let's make a deal." As a sharp businessman, "I made millions. You have thousands of blot Gemara. So let's make a deal. I'll give you half of my fortune if you give me half of your portion in the next world." So he was, you know what I mean? No, you know, if you had started off, and this is really the partnership of the what is known as the partnership of Yisachar and Zvulun. If you had started off as a partner and supported me, giving me half of your earnings, and I in turn would give you half of the reward of my learning, that would be a good partnership. But after I've made my fortune, I'm not giving it away just for yours. So Hillel lived, it would seem, even in the days he studied in Bovel, in great deprivation. But he had this vision and this tremendous humility that pushed him on to his greatness. It's interesting to note, when he did come to Israel, Eretz Yisrael, to study who his teachers were. Now, I'd just like to spend a little bit of time, even though this is not the subject of this lecture, in focusing on Shemaiah v'Avtalia and the teachers of Hillel. Shemaiah v'Avtalia were descendants of converts. They didn't come from a noble family, much less of a family than Hillel came from. One thing very interesting is that his Elter Zeda, in other words, the progenitor of his line, was Sancheriv. Sancheriv, the Assyrian king, who almost destroyed all of Eretz Israel, almost captured Yerushalayim, was the Elter Zeda, was the great-great-grandfather of Shemaiah and Avtalia. And in essence, we are going full circle here. We started off in the first lecture about the Assyrian conquest and how initially the 10 tribes that occupied the northern kingdom of Yisrael were exiled by the Assyrians. Later, Sancheriv, a subsequent king, tried to expand the Assyrian Empire to include even Yehuda, even the southern kingdom. He was not successful. Chazal, in the Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings, and as it's described in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, described the total decimation of Sancheriv's forces. This was the miracle that they set Hallel on, just as they set Hallel on the night of Pesach. According to one opinion, actually it occurred really at the night of Pesach, the decimation of Sancheriv's forces. And we have full circle that the one who is about to destroy the Jews, in turn his posterity are the one who served us so greatly in one of the most difficult periods of Jewish history. When Hillel went up, this was in the time relatively peace. This was when Salome was the queen. Yanai, her husband, the Tzaduki, had already passed away. It was a period of relative calm before the storm. But in the subsequent years, as we've studied, after Salome passed away, there was the civil war. Many lives were lost. Eventually, the Romans gained complete domination of Eretz Yisrael. And it was in difficult times that Shmai of Aptalion led the nation. It was in those times that Hillel was their disciple. And if we look at the life of Hillel, and we could figure out exactly when Hillel was born, there's, if you look on page 1, in paragraph C, it says, Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, and Shimon. Because Hillel had a son Shimon, who had in turn had a son Gamliel, who had in turn a son Shimon, Shimon ben Gamliel, had the position of Nasi, each one of them had the position of the president of Sanhedrin for a total period of 100 years while the Beis HaMikdash was still standing. In other words, 100 years before the destruction of the temple, Hillel became the Nasi. He became the Nasi when he was 80 years old. And that we have in paragraph B. In other words, Hillel went up above the age of 40, studied the sages for 40, and led the Jewish people for 40. In other words, Hillel was born 180 years before the destruction of the temple. There's another significance to the number 180 years. There's a Gemara in Avodah Zorah and Chesamud Beis and Tesamud Aleph that explain that 180 years before the destruction of the temple were the beginnings of Roman domination over Eretz Yisrael. But despite the fact that the Romans signed a peace treaty, first with Yehuda Maccabee, and later on with Shimon, his brother, the last surviving of the Hashmonaim. It seems 26 years after that last treaty with Shimon, they broke it. How they broke it is not described in the Gemara. In all likelihood, they started exacting tribute from the Jews, just as they exacted tribute for all the nations around. In Syria, they had already exacted tribute. So even though they had not actually pounced on the Jews, this was some years before Pompey actually went and captured, he conquered the Beis HaMikdash, captured Jerusalem. But even so, the Romans beginning to have a hold on Eretz Yisrael. The year the Romans started, that's when Hillel was born. And in all probability, it's the same year, or approximately the same time, that Yochanan Hyrcanus, the son of Shimon, the last surviving brother of the Maccabees, became a Tzaduki. So in the beginning, what ushered in the darkest period of our history, Roman domination, this is the beginning of the Sadducee domination, as the Tzaddukim. We know with all the killings and wars that resulted, a star was born. That marked the birth of Hillel. And when Hillel came originally to Eretz Yisrael to learn by Shmai of Aptalion, especially the fact is he had no support. I mean, his brother, even if it was in Bovel, he wasn't offering any support. He had left his family behind. In other words, he just came with his wife and kids. And the only way to support himself was through manual labor. The Rambam brings the version that he was a woodcutter. And the Gemara goes on page 2, in paragraph F. A fascinating story that probably many of you are very familiar with. And I'd like to read this. They said regarding Hillel the elder, that every day he would work and earn a tarpik. A tarpik is a half of a dinar. A dinar is, they would be probably closest to what we'd call a dollar. Just give you a sense of the buying power of a dinar. A person could live with 200 dinorim. In other words, 200 norm was the poverty level. If a person did not have possessed 200 dinorim, which is the equivalent of one could live a year, one was eligible for the entitlements for Miser Oni, for the tithe that goes to the poor, for the payas, Lekat, Shikha, those which are given the corner which is left off in the field, or the gleanings, or the forgotten sheaf. So Hillel had to pay a half of a... So Hillel earned a half of a tarpik a day, which in a sense for his whole family, which basically is throughout a year is, what, 180, 182 tarpiks for a whole family, when the poverty level for an individual was 200. Now, they charged, to go to the Beis Medrash in the Shir, they charged half of a tarpik for an entrance fee in the Beis Medrash. So he would give half of what he made for the day to the watchman of the study hall. And with the other half, he supported himself and his family. One day, he couldn't find any work. Without the necessary fee, the watchman wouldn't let him in. No tiki, no washi. Hillel climbed up and sat at the skylight of the study hall. And the building was made in such a way that there was a hole, or there was some glass, or some protection. But he was by the skylight, and he sat by there so as to hear the words of the living God, Tivrilakim Chaim, from the mouths of Shmaya Vaptalyan. So he couldn't go in directly, so he climbed up on the roof to listen. There's a tradition that day was an Erev Shabbos. It was right before Shabbos. It was the middle of the winter, and a tremendous amount of snow fell all over him. And he kept on, like his ear was to pick up the words, and he was oblivious to what was happening. And evidently he had fallen asleep, which is very common because of the cold. At the beginning of dawn, this isn't already Shabbos, Shmaya said, Zavtalyan, my brother, every day the room is bright, and today it's dark, because he had covered, with his form of his body, he had covered the skyline. Perhaps it's cloudy today. Evidently it had stopped snowing already. They looked closely and saw a human form on the skylight. They went up and found 3 cubits of snow on top of Hillel. They extracted him, washed him, anointed him, and smeared him with oil, and then placed him opposite the bonfire that was going in the study hall. And they made the comment that for such a person like Hillel, it was truly worthwhile to violate Shabbos. The Gemara brings this example to cite the point that when on the final judgment day, and everyone is judged, there are no excuses. And if someone will plead poverty and will say, well, I couldn't learn Torah, I was too poor to just spend all my time making a living. The person says, were you poorer than Hillel? Hillel was determined, and he developed himself into the great Hillel. Your problem was not poverty, your problem was determination. It seems, from the historians, and this is the viewer of Isaac Halevi, that Shmaya Vaptalyan were Nesiim, had that position of the heads of the Sanhedrin for some 20 years. After they died, there was a void. In the interim, while Shmaya and Avtalion were actually the heads of the Sanhedrin, as we discussed in the previous lecture, the Romans, who firmly took control of Eretz Yisrael, were afraid of the power of the Sanhedrin and proclaimed that they could no longer sit as a unified body, and created five equal Sanhedrins throughout Eretz Yisrael, so that one couldn't say that all the great scholars and all the great authorities were in one place and their opinion would be final, because they're scattered all over. And this is a point we've made in a previous lecture, that even though throughout the ages in courtroom proceedings there's always been differences of opinions, even though once clearly knew the Torah Shebaal Peh, but there would be a question of how to apply it in a certain situation, but there would always be the majority rule. They would get together, they would discuss it, they would come to a final vote, and that final vote would be binding on all. The majority's opinion would be the final opinion. But that's only when there's face-to-face discussions and they're all together. But with five equal Sanhedrins, even though one could say, well, still the majority holds this way or that way, they never got together. The minority never really articulated its view in front of the majority. The minority could have at least the benefit of, well, if I could have really had my piece and argued my case, maybe I would have been able to convince them. That wasn't the case. Yes? They were not allowed by the Roman government because of the fear of their power. This Gabinus, who was the Roman general and governor at the time, did to cement his power, the Roman power. This happened in the wake of a revolt that they had just crushed, and they were afraid of subsequent revolts. And they wanted to empower, give greater power to Hyrcanus, who was the high priest, a descendant of the house of the Maccabees, a Sadducee, Sadduki, but to give him the power, and Antipater, his advisor, who was an Idumean, as we said, who was the father of Herod. In order to cement their position, they compromised the position of the Sanhedrin. It's not clear if Shmaya and Avtalion were alive when the split of the Sanhedrin into five parts happened, or they were not. But when Hillel, who evidently left Israel when Shmaya and Avtalion passed away, some years later when he came back, there was no clear head of the Sanhedrin. What we find was a family, the B'nai Becerra. The B'nai Becerra, the sons of Becerra, were a prestigious family. Evidently, the name B'nai Becerra does not mean sons necessarily, that Becerra was their father. It could have been a great-great-grandfather. You know, just so it would be named like Abramson. There was an Abraham way back in the family, and in the subsequent generations are called by that name. In fact, the Tosfos and Tainus and Chof Amud Beis in 20b makes the point that Ibn Ezra, the famous Avram Ibn Ezra, was not the son of Ezra. His father's name actually was Meir. Ibn Ezra was a family name. It was rare for the French-German authors of the Tosfos, and they quoted it, because they didn't have family names in Germany and France at the time. In the 12th, 13th century. Similarly, B'nai Becerra seems to have been a family name. And we find later on in history, again, the family of B'nai Becerra. This family were the equivalent of the leadership during that period. So they were the thing closest to being the leaders. When Hillel was 80 years old, he was thrust into the position of leadership. Evidently, this was after years of going back to Babel and perhaps studying further. By an interesting incident, and this is what you find on page 3. As Tosfos explains in Psochem in Samach Vovah Medalef in 66a, the Romans had, as we're going to see the backdrop of this story, the Romans had had made breaches in the wall of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was not really considered a walled city. And something, there was no Erev in Jerusalem. So you couldn't carry in Jerusalem. It had particular problems, the inability to carry. If Erev Pesach, the eve of Pesach, when everyone has to go and bring their Paschal lamb, the Korban Pesach, or the goat, and bring their knives to the Beis HaMikdash, is a real problem. Because you just can't carry. Normally, what was done in a Shabbos in the temple, everything was there. It was an enclosed building and everything was there. But on Pesach, you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people converging on Yerushalayim. They all have to bring all their sacrifices. And it was a very difficult thing to do without Chil Shabbos. And it seems, at least this is how the historians understand, that therefore the Chachomim, the scholars, arranged the calendar so that it never came out on Shabbos, as the Erev Pesach never came out on Shabbos, to avoid the Shabbos problem. It seems, though, that because there were so many years had gone by, that it never, that it never came to be, that under the leadership of B'nai B'Sera, it seems that because they didn't exercise their leadership in that way, or whatever the reason was, they did not tamper with the calendar this specific year, and Erev Pesach came out on Shabbos. They had a dual problem. One was the problem exactly how, what are they going to do here? I mean, how are they going to finesse, everyone's going to bring their sacrifice, and how are they going to carry the knives, how are they going to bring it? But besides that particular problem, there was another, even a more important problem. They had forgotten, since it had been so many years, you know, since it had actually been brought on Shabbos, they had really forgotten that even if it's allowed to be brought on Shabbos, it was because of other circumstances, and the calendar had been tampered with, so many years had gone by, that you'd never brought it, people began to wonder, hey, why didn't they bring it? Why did they tamper with the calendar? Was it just a caring problem, or maybe something more fundamental? Maybe because of the bringing the sacrifice involves slaughtering, which you normally can't do on Shabbos. It brings burning things on the altar, which again you can't normally do on Shabbos. Maybe you just can't bring a Korban Pesach on Shabbos anytime. So when for some reason, which is not clear, that they did not tamper with the calendar that year, they did not fix it up so that to avoid the Shabbos problem, it did fall on Shabbos, they were at a quandary what to do, and there was nobody there to at least from the scholars, who had a clear recollection of the past, you know, or, you know, were knew the halacha itself. And this, I think it's worthwhile on page 3, in paragraph A. The rabbis taught us that this halacha, that a Korban Pesach is brought on Shabbos, was forgotten by the B'nai B'Sera, the family that was acting in the capacity of president of the Sanhedrin. One time, Erev Pesach fell out on Shabbos. This is the eve of Pesach. The B'nai B'Sera, this family of great scholars, forgot and did not know whether the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, has precedent over Shabbos or not. They asked, does anyone know if Pesach has precedence over Shabbos? And they were told there was one man who came up from Babylon, and Hillel the Babylonian is his name, who studied under Shmai of Aftalion and knows if the Korban Pesach takes precedence. But they actually they were not familiar with him. They didn't know him personally. They were just told of such a person. That means he was 80 years old at the time. He said to them, first he wanted to prove to them that this is a conclusion, you should have arrived at it yourself. Because after all, what's the difference of a Paschal lamb, or the regular continual offering that's brought every Shabbos? I mean, we do know that there are circumstances that one is allowed, is required, to bring a sacrifice on Shabbos. And that's a continual offering. Because a continual offering, it's either now or never. If you don't do it now, you won't do it. You can't push it aside. So too, the Korban Pesach, can only be brought on the 14th day of Nisan. If you don't bring it that day, it can't be brought. So he went on to prove to them, first logically, which they disagreed with, but then finally he proved to them by tradition that he had studied personally by Shmai of Avtalion, that the Korban Pesach takes precedence over Shabbos and one is required to bring the Korban. There's an interesting note that the Gemara makes, that after he had come to this, he had pronounced this ruling, the B'nai B'Sera were so taken by his scholarship that they went and said, what are we doing having the position of leadership as president of the Sanhedrin? And in fact, they gave over the mantle of leadership then and there to Hillel. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is quoted as saying in the Yerushalmi, this is the Yerushalmi in Kilayim, that even though he is known as a family of great humility, the feat, the ability of the B'nai B'Sera to give over their position of power and leadership of honor immediately, without question, because they found the better person, is something that, he says, that goes beyond even my, as Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is saying, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, one of the most humble of history, this is even beyond my capabilities. And when Hillel got the position, he started giving them Musar, he started chastising them, and telling them, says, why is it that I, a foreigner, should gain position of leadership over you? You know why? Because when Shmai of Aftalion were alive, you didn't take the opportunity to study at his feet, to be with him day and night. Because if you would have, had that devotion and that determination, says, I wouldn't be in this position. You'd still have your shteli, you'd still have your position. And after he chastised them, a question came to them. It says, fine, that's wonderful. We have to bring the Korban Pesach. But what happened to all these people who don't have their knives? They didn't realize this, and there's a whole to-do now. How are we going to bring it? There's not enough knives in the Beis HaMikdash itself, in the temple itself. The people we're going to bring the sacrifice, the animals have to bring the knives. Those knives are home. And as we said before, Yerushalayim was no longer considered a truly walled city because so many breaches in the city. So you couldn't carry there on Shabbos. And Hillel forgot. He says, he meekly said, I don't remember. But one thing about the Jewish people If they're not truly prophets, they're the sons or disciples of prophets. There's a sense of prophetic. Jews instinctively will know what to do. So what happened was they weren't told what to do, but what the Jews did is they figured that the easiest way to avoid desecration of Shabbos would be if they put the knives on the animals themselves. They hadn't sanctified the animals yet. That they would do when they would come into the temple. So because unless a sacrificial animal you can't use, you can't make it carry anything. But here they didn't sanctify the animal yet. They put it, you know, by their horns or in their wool, and they carried it. And when Hillel saw it, Hillel remembered and said, "Ah, I remember." He said, "That's what my Rebbe taught me." Now the Gemara makes the point, you know, why did he forget it? He says, and the Gemara makes this, a person who's mizgoa, a person who prides himself, if he's a Talmud Chacham, says his learning is forgotten. And brings the thing from Hillel. That he should have taken the position, instead of using it as an opportunity to give the Musar, that I had the opportunity to study under Shmaya. I took that opportunity, you didn't. Because he took that position, he was punished by having forgotten what he had learned. And it gives a Musar to all of us in terms of humility. And Hillel was a truly humble person. I'm not saying he was an arrogant person. But great people are judged by a very high standard. And on Hillel's Madrega, on the standard that Hillel lived his life, it was just out of character for him to start looking down at them and start chastising them that way. So then that's why he was punished. We know, and this is a point we've discussed in the previous lecture, that in the position of the Sanhedrin, there are actually two leadership positions. One was the Nasi, the president, the chief position of leadership. And there was a second, which was the Av Beis Din, the head of the court. The Nasi not only was had the highest position within the Sanhedrin, but he was the representative of the Sanhedrin as the president to the outside world. The Sanhedrin took care of social needs. The Gemara makes the point, and this is the Gemara in Gitin Lamed Zayin, that the Rabbi Gamliel, who was the head of the Sanhedrin at that time, was the Avi Shel Yesoimim. He is the father of all the orphans. There, the social needs are in the hands of the Sanhedrin. The person that was picked to be the Av Beis Din of the Sanhedrin, and we were speaking about this was a more of a nominal position rather than being the full Sanhedrin in the sense we've always known this as a central place, and all questions would be addressed to them and answered because they actually were scattered. It was more of a, it would seem, more of an honorary position than having the full power of a Sanhedrin, because they were divided and were not allowed to have all the scholars come together, you know, at least in an official manner. But this position of Av Beis Din was given to a person called Menachem. Who this Menachem was is a point of very interesting speculation. Who was this Menachem? There's only one quote we have from him in all of Mishnayos, this Menachem. If you look, it says on page 3 in paragraph C. And this is regarding the issue of Smicha. This is a point we've discussed before. The first argument that was unresolved was the question of, is smicha putting one's hands and leaning on a sacrifice, if one brings the sacrifice on Yom Tov, is that allowed or not allowed? Normally you're not allowed to lean on a
You're not allowed to lean on an animal on Yom Tov. You're not allowed to ride an animal. They expanded the prohibition. Not only aren't you allowed to ride the animal, you're not allowed to use an animal. You're not to lean on an animal. Is one allowed to lean on an animal if it's for the purpose of the mitzvah, fulfilling the mitzvah of the preparation of the sacrifice? This was a long-standing argument, but Hillel and Menachem did not disagree. Even though in the previous generations there was a disagreement, Hillel, who was the Nasi, the president, Menachem, who was the Abbez, did not disagree on this point. But Menachem left his position, and Shammai took his place, and Shammai did disagree with Hillel. The Gemara asked the question, this is all the Mishnah tells us. The Gemara asked the question, where did Menachem go? It says he left. It didn't say he died, it says he left. Abaye said that he went out onto a path of heresy. Yotzulatarbus wrote. Rava said that he went out to the service of the king, this is Herod, not one of the great tzaddikim of history, and 80 pairs of his disciples followed him, clothed in royal garb. In other words, as we're going to see, his 80 disciples followed him into royal service. It's still a tremendous question mark. Who was he? Why would a person of that stature go into government service, especially for a person like Herod? He must have been a person of stature, otherwise he would not have been appointed to a position right under Hillel. On the other hand, how does a person like that just turn around and go into Herod's court? The first position of Abai is also very difficult, in that, I mean, we do know that it happens, but it is just very strange that a person, I mean, you know, a person of such a dignity should just become a heretic overnight. It is strange. It seems, though, from Josephus in his Book of Antiquities, that we are filled in a little more about this Menachem. And it seems from historians, and it seems from Isaac Halevi, that the Menachem discussed in Antiquities is the same Menachem discussed in Chagiga. Menachem was one of the Essenes. This was the sect of Jews that may have been very learned, but had different views about one's approach to life. As we said, Josephus stated in the previous lecture, that they disagreed about the role of fate and free will. The Pharisees, the Purushim, the Rabbonim, believed in the idea of free will. God is involved in this world, but he gives us place to exercise our free will. According to the Essenes, everything is fated. By and large, they did not get married. They lived a very monastic, ascetic type of a life, very different than the mainstream normal life that the Purusha and the Pharisees led. This Menachem was one of the leaders of the Essenes, and he got into Herod's good graces. You turn page 4 in paragraph D, that when Herod was a little boy and going to school, this Menachem greeted him as the king of the Jews. And at that time, he had no inkling that he would be the king. His father was merely an advisor to Hyrcanus. This is before the years that his father became officially governor of Judea. He was given the official position by the Romans. He was just a counselor. And yet this Menachem prophesied, "You are going to be the king." And he denied it, and he said, "It's nothing," and he slapped him on the back, and he said, "You'll be the king. Just don't worry about it." Years later, when he became the king, and you can read the details on page 4, he had great respect for this Menachem. And he sent for Menachem afterwards, and he asked him, you know, says, you have such the gift of prophecy. How long am I going to reign? Menachem didn't tell him, but he says it will be for a very long time. He said, yes, 20, nay, 30 years. And Herod did, in actuality, he was king for over 30 years. Herod was satisfied with these replies. He gave Menachem his hand and dismissed him. And from that time, he continued to honor all the Essenes. It's the view of Isaac Halevi and others that this Menachem is the same Menachem. The position of Nossi and Ab Beis Din, even though Hillel was honored as the greatest teacher, were more of a symbolic position than an actual position, because there was no true acting Sanhedrin at the time. And to cement the various sects, it was felt as a political move originally to give Menachem the position of Ab Beis Din in order to get the good graces of Herod, because Herod, he knew, was on good footing with this Menachem, and also to bring the Essenes closer to mainstream Jewry. But the Shidduch did not last too long, and they parted ways. And it could very well be that both opinions, Abaye says Yotzel Tarbis Ra, who went on to heresy, and the opinion of Rava, that he, the tradition of Rava, that he went out with all his students to the service of the king, are both equally true. And basically they parted ways, because after all, he was an Essene. The Essenes had made a compromise, basically what they felt was in their best interest at that time, and they viewed their interests differently as time went on. The person who took Menachem's place, of course, was Shammai. Hillel brought, besides his great learning, he brought to Klal Yisrael in the very difficult times. This was the time of Herod. This was a time of mass killings. A new spirit of love. It says, Hillel and Shammai, says on page 4, paragraph E, received the Torah from Shammai and Aphtalion. They're both students of his. Hillel said, this is in Pirkei Avos, be from the students of Aaron, love peace, pursue peace, which was very important in those times. Love humanity and bring them closer to Torah. And it's remarkable, and this is the fact that Josephus writes about, that both Hillel and Shammai had a very special place in Herod's heart. The reason that that Josephus gives is a bit strange, though. At least when it comes to Hillel, he calls Hillel, which it seems is polio. Not only this, I mean, it's a Latinized version of Hillel, the Pharisee, and Sammeus, this is Shammai, a disciple of his, were honored by him, by Herod, above all the rest. And the reason that he says is that for when Yerushalayim was besieged, they advised the citizens to receive Herod, for which advice they were well requited. So there was one thing, as they gave advice. This is really questionable if Hillel was in Yerushalayim at the time. In a previous section, he quotes this Shammai is the one who would gave the advice to the inhabitants of Yerushalayim that when Herod was attacking, was surrounding them, to give up and to go into the to cease fighting. And he quotes again Hillel here, which he quoted in the name of Shammai before, that this polio, at the time when Herod was once upon his trial of life and death, this is in the last lecture, foretold in way of reproach to Hyrcanus and the other judges, how this Herod, whom they suffered now to escape, would afterwards inflict punishment on them, all which had its completion in time, while God fulfilled the words he had spoken. Previously, Josephus quotes this, retells this story, but it was Shammai who did this, which again makes more sense, because in that period of time, Hillel was actually was back in Bavel. It would seem then that the respect that he had of Hillel was just more than personal dealings, which was a thing of, which was the case of Shammai, was perhaps his own personality himself, that he knew that Hillel was no threat to him. Another interesting incident, which is on the top of page 5, is that he made the Pharisees swear an oath of allegiance to him, and if they didn't, they would be put to death. He endeavored also to persuade Pollio, this is Hillel, the Pharisee, and Semaias, the Shammai, and the greatest part of their scholars, and this is base Shammai and base Hillel, to take the oath, that these would neither submit so to do, nor were they punished together with the rest, out of reverence he bore to Pollio. So this is to Hillel. If it isn't the respect that he gave him was not because of the fact that he stood up to him, that was Shammai, or that he opened up the gates of Yerushalayim, which was Shammai, it must have been because of the special personality that Hillel had. We have an inkling into Hillel the teacher, what kind of a yeshiva he had, what were his students. In section 3 here on page 5, in paragraph A, the Obister of Nosson, this is an expansion of the Pirkei Avos, of the Tractate Avos, it brings a brisa, it brings teachings to clarify what was said in Pirkei Avos. Regarding the statement in the beginning of Pirkei Avos, the first Mishnah in Avos, which is a statement of the Anshei Knesset HaGdol, the men of the Great Assembly, the Hamidu Salmidim Harbe, you should establish many disciples. The Avos Reb Nosson understands that mitzvah, that request of the Anshei Knesset HaGdol, the men of the Great Assembly, that you should all have many students, to allude to that they should be Hillels rather than Shammais. Shammai was very selective in who he brought into his yeshiva. He took the smartest, the finest, from the best families, those who could support themselves so they could continue on their learning. They didn't have to moonlight for an extra job. And he picked only the best to be in his yeshiva. Hillel had a much more liberal policy of who he let in. And in fact, Hillel took everyone in. And he says, the Torah has a tremendous power. Whereas Beis Hillel said, similar to the men of the Great Assembly, teach all people. There were many sinners amongst the Jewish people who were brought close to the study of Torah and eventually became righteous and pious. As a result, though, because he had such a liberal admissions policy, the Beis Hillel, his yeshiva, was a much larger institution than Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai, on the other hand, maintained that even though they have the minority, they basically have quality over quantity. And they were, as a group, says we're mechadet tefei, were much sharper than that of Beis Hillel.
How far apart were they?
The yeshivas?
Yeah.
Well, if you were you in the old city in Yerushalayim? It's right there. Everything is right there. But, well, there was a problem of mixing between the Beis Shammai and the Beis Hillel because the Romans did not let them be together. I mean, that's why Shammai had to have his yeshiva separate than Hillel. Even though Shammai, logic would say, well, Shammai is the Av Beis Din. He is the second to Hillel. Hillel is the Nasi. He is the head of the Sanhedrin. Logic would dictate, well, then everybody should be together. It's one Sanhedrin. Pool all the resources. Why is it that there's a Beis Shammai and a Beis Hillel as two distinct groups? Because that's the way the Romans wanted it. I mean, they really weren't able to do it. They were really, their hands were tied. What complicated matters, though, was that since Beis Shammai was, let's say, an elite group, so to speak, was the Mechadat Tfei, they would have a problem even later on combining in a, going into a Sanhedrin by virtue of, well, who is going to, a Sanhedrin only has 70 members. Who is going to take these slots? And why should we be outvoted by people that we consider our inferiors? So it created all kinds of problems, but it was the best they could do in a very bad situation. But I want to give you an idea that even though we look at the students of Shammai as Mechadat Tfei as very sharp, in no way could we consider, in a historical sense, the students of Hillel as inferior people. Now, I'd like to read with you here as on page 5. I think it's an eye-opener. In paragraph B, Hillel the elder had 80 prime disciples. 30 of them were worthy of the Shekhinah resting on them as it rested on Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, there were such tzaddikim, there were such saints. 30 of them were worthy of a miracle, of the miracle of the sun standing still as it had occurred through Yeshua ben Nun. And there was Joshua when the sun stood still. They're dealing now not with the scholarship, but with their saintliness. 20 were average. The greatest of them was Yonasan ben Uzziel. He is the Aramaic translation we have of the book of the work of the prophets is the work of Yonasan ben Uzziel. The smallest of them was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He seems from the lowest of the average, fair to middling. What? Yeah. What did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai know? So here, it has been said regarding Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that the expertise in scripture, Mishnah, Gemara, Halachas, Agodas, the inferences made from the careful reading of scriptural texts, this is the Diktukei Torah, the enactments of the rabbis, this is the Diktukei Sofrim, the principles of hermeneutics, in other words, this is the, Kal v'chomer, Gzeira Shava, calculations for the season, fixing the calendars, gematrias, the speech of the angels, the speech of the demons, the speech of the palm trees, as Rashi says he doesn't know what that means, parables of the launders and the foxes. You know, this is like similar to the Aesop's fables. These were fables that were used to teach a moral point. He was an expert in that area. The great topic was the function of the divine chariot, Maisa Merkava. And the relatively minor topic means the Talmudic discussions of Abaye and Rava, the analysis and the questions and back and the forth. This was the smallest of this was the expertise of the smallest of the students. This was a fulfillment of the verse to give substance as an inheritance to my beloved. And their treasure houses will I fill. In other words, this is a blessing from Hashem that a human being was capable of such a knowledge. So since the smallest disciple of Hillel reached such a level, we can assume that the level was most certainly reached by his greatest disciple. It has been said regarding Yonah ben Uzziel that at a time he would be sitting and involving himself with the study of Torah, a bird that would fly by would be immediately burned. It was by the Kedusha, by the this divine fire that would surround him. That's an inkling of the students of Hillel. Of Hillel himself, on page 6 in paragraph C, once the sages were sitting in the upper floor of Beis Guria in Jericho, near Yericho, and a voice from heaven issued forth and said, "There is one here who is worthy of the Shekhinah resting upon him, just as it rested upon Moshe Rabbeinu. His generation, however, does not merit this." And as the reason prophecy came to an end was not that there weren't people worthy of prophecy, but prophecy is a gift to the generation. This is how Hashem communicates to the generation. The generation was not worthy of this. The sages turned their eyes towards Hillel the elder. When he died, they said of him, this is a very famous eulogy that was said to great people, says, "Hai Chosid, is that pious one, Hai Onav, that humble one, the spiritual disciple of Ezra." And Hillel left his mark on his generation. He left his mark on his students. You're all familiar with the story, I'm sure, about the prospective gerim, non-Jews who came to convert, who had some who had ridiculous demands in order to that they would consider conversion. One of them said, "Well, I'll only convert if you teach me all of the Torah standing on one foot." He first went to Shammai. Shammai felt that there was an insincerity, and that he would, normally one only accepts converts if there's true sincerity on their part. And he felt for frivolous people, he just didn't have the time. He went to Hillel, though, and Hillel says, "Fine, good, we'll enter the conversion process. What's all the Torah on one foot? That which is distasteful to you, don't do to your fellow man. Don't you? That is the essence of the Torah. Everything else is merely a commentary. So you'll have to go study the commentary, but that's the essence." And with that, he was satisfied. He became a convert. One of them came to Shammai, and he says, "I'll become a convert, but only accept the Torah Shebiksav, the written one. I won't accept the Torah Shebal Peh, which is the oral, which is the essence of the Torah." Again, he didn't have much patience for him, and Shammai felt he wasn't a true convert, pushed him aside. Hillel says, "Wonderful. But you have to learn." So he started learning with him. So the first day, he started on Olive Base. You can imagine, this is Hillel, the greatest scholar in Eretz Yisrael, in a land full of scholars. He's a man who's well over 80 years old. I mean, this is after Shammai had, come into his own already. He's an Elta Yid, And he comes to a person who's not even Jewish to teach him Aleph Beis. He says, "Fine." So they started, "This is an Aleph." He said, "Repeat after me, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Aleph." Okay, it's enough for today's lesson. He says, "Come back tomorrow." Comes back tomorrow. He points to the Aleph and he says, "Dalet." And he points to the Beis and he says, "Gimel." And the guy's looking at him and says, he points to the Gimel Beis and Dalet, "That's an Aleph." And the guy says, it doesn't sound like, "Hey, you didn't teach that to me. Hey, that's wrong. The other way, that's an..." He says, "How do you know which way is right? Ultimately, even names of letters, you have to have an oral tradition. You ultimately believe in an oral tradition. If you trust me in the oral tradition, what's a Aleph, what's a Beis, you can trust me with the oral tradition, what does a Torah mean as well?" He was satisfied and became a true convert. There was a third fellow who came to him and said, he had heard, evidently he had some knowledge of Hebrew, and he heard about the raiments of the high priest. And he says, you know what? I want to become a high priest. So he came to Shammai. He says, I want to convert, but only if you make me high priest. Well, you can know what Shammai did to him. He says, came to Hillel. Says, fine. Wonderful. But, you can't become a high priest if you don't learn tricks of the trade. You have to know what it is to be a high priest. So, we'll study about the priesthood. And they came to a verse, says, Zor HaKorev, says Yumos, says the stranger who comes close will be put to death. Says, who, to do the service in the temple. Who is that referring to? This is King David. I mean, King David will be put to death? Yeah, he's not a Kohen. He's not from the descendants of Aaron. He says, King David is going to be put to death. Me? Most certainly, he says, I'm not deserving of the high priesthood. So he got the Mishigas out of his mind, and he became a true convert. Eventually, these three converts met on a street together in Yerushalayim. Like we said, it's a small place. They met together, and they came, it was because of the patience of Hillel that brought us under the Kanfei HaShechinah, the wings of divine presence. It's far better to be a Hillel, in terms of how to act, than the way that Shammai acted. Even though Shammai had all the right to act, but Shammai, in a sense, was Midas HaDin. He did everything right, but Hillel was this Midas HaAva, this Midas HaChesed, the love, the kindness, way beyond the call of duty that brought these people closer. And his personality didn't just have an effect on the people around him, it had a profound effect, interestingly enough, on the whole process of halacha. And the last, on page 6, in paragraph D, there's a Gemara in Erevin in Yud Gimel Amud Beis 13b. Rabbi Abba said that Shmuel said that for 3 years Beis Shammai disagreed with Beis Hillel. It seems this is in the period of Yavna. This is after the Sanhedrin had already left Yerushalayim. It was probably after the destruction of the temple. The remnants of Jewry came together. This Beis Shammai were no longer personal students of Shammai; they were disciples of disciples of Shammai. But they disagreed. They came together. This already at the time of Yavna, they wanted to cease the existence of separate yeshivas, separate Beis Shammai, and a separate Beis Hillel. There should be a unified Sanhedrin once again. There's a question, once it's unified, who should we rule like? In other words, there were over 300 differences in practical Jewish life. There was important to have a decision, what should the Psak Halacha be? What should the final ruling be? So Beis Shammai said that the halacha should be like us, basically because Beis Shammai are greater logicians. They were mechadidei tfei, they were sharper. And Beis Hillel said the halacha should be like us because we represent the majority of scholarly opinion. A bas kol, a voice from heaven, an echo of heaven came out, which was heard. And he says, Elu ve'elu divru l'kim chaim, these and those are the words of the living God. In other words, in halacha, in a situation when one does not clearly know what to do, we don't have a clear tradition what Moses taught us, what Moshe Rabbeinu taught us, we have to rely on the teachings of the Sanhedrin, those following with their traditions and with their methodology to attempt to reconstruct what originally Moshe Rabbeinu taught. And of course, we're dealing with humans, and humans look at different issues differently. There will be divergence of opinion. What the Torah really made room for this divergence, this is whatever the Sanhedrin decides, it's as if Hashem says, this may not be the original Torah, but you've attempted to reconstruct it with the best that you can, says, I will grant that legitimacy. This is how this is a medrash that says this is this is the Chachmei Tzorfas, the scholars of France that are quoted in the Ritva, maintain this is the meaning of the words. These and those are the words of the living God. It's not necessarily what I said, but I give it credence. But the halacha has been decided according to the opinion of Beis Hillel. In other words, you should still follow by the dictates of this Baskol. You should accept who your Rebbe should be Hillel. Beis Hillel should be your teacher. When you have two schools of thought, Elu Velu Divrei Elokim Chayim, these are the words of living God, I, who is uninformed, could decide to be a student of Beis Shammai, I could decide to be a student of Beis Hillel. I don't know what to do. We have disagreements to this day in certain halachic issues. But if I come from that city, or I'm a student of this Rebbe, or whatever it is, I follow his opinion. That opinion has validity. So despite the fact they both have validity, it was decided from heaven that all of the Jewry should follow the opinion of Beis Hillel. Not because they're necessarily right. I am not telling you who is right. In other words, once the Torah was given, God does not reveal to us what Moshe Rabbeinu originally taught. Loi b'shamayim hi. The Torah is no longer in heaven. He's not telling us who. By saying we rule like Beis Hillel is not saying that this is how I taught the Torah originally. Or if when they're disagreeing in rabbinic law, this is how the rabbinic law was originally formulated. We don't know. I'm not telling you. But I am telling you that all of Jewry should accept Beis Hillel to be their authority, to be their Rebbe. Why? Because they were pleasant and humble. So this is Shenoichin Valuvin. So in addition, not only did they repeat, when they discussed their opinions, they gave equal time to the opinions of those that disagree with them. They would repeat the words of Beis Shammai. And they stated they would repeat the words, and they would state the opinion of Beis Shammai before they stated their own opinion. Hillel's influence on his students was such that they, even in the halachic process, when the menschlichkeit, the midos, was there even as they presented their halachas. And the Gemara comes out by the fact is that basically nice guys finish first is really the not like Leo DeRocher's. We can derive from this story the following principles. One who humbles himself will be elevated by Hashem. They still will humble themselves. One who attempts to elevate himself, however, will eventually be humbled by Hashem. Evidently, it looks to be a critique on Beis Shammai. One who attempts to achieve domination will find it to be an elusive goal. On the other hand, one who runs away from being in a position of power will find that position chasing him. One who pushes to achieve when the time is not auspicious will be in turn pushed away. One who lets time take its course will find that eventually his time will come. This concludes this 15 lecture series. We've spanned a period of some 500 years. And
we hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.